Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another exciting episode of Bright Brains. Today, we're going to delve into the complexities of the human mind and the journeys that shape men's mental health. I'm Isaac Walker, and today we have the privilege of speaking with Julian Quickstad, a psychology major at York University in Toronto. Julian's passion lies in understanding and advocating for men's mental health. Drawing from his extensive experience working with boys on the autism spectrum and as a crisis responder for a helpline. Welcome to the show, Julian.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Hey, no problem. I'm definitely excited to talk to you. So tell us a little bit about yourself and your background.
Okay, yeah. So I was born and raised in Alberta, Canada. And I grew up in a small town, a farming community. And now I'm actually living in Toronto. As you said, I'm a psychology major, going to school at York University. And I guess the start of my story in this journey with mental health, it started, I was in the oil field since I was 16. So I started as like a laborer, and then I eventually went to school for power engineering. And I worked as an operator in the oil sands up in Fort McMurray. And I lived away, camp life, away for weeks at a time when I did my shifts. So that was part of where I got introduced to the negative side of mental health. And then during that time, I was in a quite abusive relationship, toxic relationship. And there was mental abuse or some sexual abuse with that too. And then I ended up really diving into some drugs and trying to cope with that, the whole situation there, which ultimately also led to some more traumatic experiences. And after that, I went to rehab, and I spent, well, numerous hours in therapy and do medication, just to get in a state where I am now, which I think is a good place. I have a amazing wife and a amazing 9-month-old son now too. And I'm just happy to be here.
Awesome, man. I'm glad to see that you're doing better. So it's a lot we can talk about. But first, I kind of want to talk about life in the oil field. You know, everything I've heard about that, it seems like a harsh life. And you said you were 16. Is that common, being a 16-year-old in the oil field?
Yeah, you can. So that's like the biggest. Ever since, I don't know, probably 13, 14, I just seen all these dads and older men working in the oil field, and they made good money. So I was like, that's my dream. That's what I'm going to be. And as 16, I just did like lease maintenance. So, you know, it's just like going on the oil leases and cutting the grass on it, keeping it tidy, just small stuff like that. But then I would say it's actually pretty common for like high school kids in rural Alberta to get jobs like that. So
that's interesting. Yeah, I've never met anybody who's worked in those oil fields. Now, those oil fields, they're mostly men, right? It's like hardly any women there.
Oh, geez. I don't even know what the percentage is. It's probably like 95% men.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's interesting that we're talking about men's mental health and you worked in a field that was predominantly men. You probably have like, you probably learned a lot interacting with like so many men on a daily basis. I know most jobs are primarily men, but living in an environment where you're isolated and it's all men, that probably, you probably learned some things and maybe that piqued your interest in psychology. Is that possibly the case or?
Definitely. And I don't, not everything's negative about it, but I heard someone say in a presentation recently that You're not an oil field worker until you've had a divorce or two.
Oh, wow.
And it's really common for men to have divorces. And, it's like, for example, I was up in Fort Mac for 7 days at a time. So I wouldn't see any friends or family until I came back after those 7 days. So it gets isolating, and you see other men struggle with that too. And yeah.
Yeah. How do you deal with that isolation? Do you just play video games, watch TV, read a book, or like what?
Honestly, yeah, and it takes some good mental strength, and like you have to know why you're doing it, 'cause you obviously you make money, good money doing it, but there's sacrifices to it. And it's just like you got to weigh it out. Is it for you? So.
Gotcha. So I'm assuming it looks like it's no longer for you. And you're currently, are you still doing it? Because I know you
No,
said you're a
no.
student. Yeah. All
Yeah,
right
I
then. So,
actually 3 years ago or 4 years ago, I switched,
all
came
right
back to
then.
school.
That's
Yeah.
awesome. All right then. So let's talk about your journey, going from the oil field to being a student of psychology at the University of York, or is it York University?
York University.
All right.
Yeah.
So let's talk about that journey. Where do you want to begin? Because I know we talked via email correspondence, and it looks like you've had a number of things in your life. So let's let I'm gonna let you take the lead. Where do you want to begin this journey?
You know what? I guess we could start. I think the most dramatic part of or eye-opening part of my experience was my abusive relationship. So why don't we start there?
All right, then. Let's talk about it.
Awesome. Yeah. So like I mentioned, it's isolating when you're going up on shift work, but it's also hard on your relationships too, right? Because you're away from your significant other, and not in my case at the time, but you're like your kids, stuff like that. But you're also like you're worked hard, and sometimes you come home and you just don't want to do anything. And I think the culmination of coming home tired and stuff, and then coming home to someone who wasn't quite the nicest person actually like really, really damaged my mental health and kind of what started the depression. And she was just very belittling and very demeaning to me and stuff too. But I don't know if like when I'm tired and stuff, I don't have the energy to fight back sometimes. And then it becomes normal after a while, and it just spirals and spirals and spirals. And it just, in the terms of like a toxic relationship where you're getting gaslit and all that stuff, you end up, I was ending up to isolating from my friends and family in it all. And it just made things even worse.
When you were going through all this, did anybody like reach out to you and say, how are you doing, man? Do you have any like friends who are there for you, and did they help make a difference or?
Yes and no. So that's the tricky thing, and what kind of what I wanted to talk about today is that like I think men's mental health, there's so much stigma around it, because in general the traditional sense of a man is they're like the provider, so they sacrifice their mind, their body for their family and their friends and stuff like that. Sorry, I just lost my train of thought.
No, that's all right. Yeah, as men, we're constantly told to suck it up. And oftentimes, if you do show weakness or any kind of vulnerability, women might look at that as being a weakness. And that kind of, limits our ability to seek help. So,
Yeah, sorry, that's where I was going.
yeah,
So
ain't no
I
problem.
actually hid it. I actually kind of tried to hide it as much as I could. Because I didn't want people to know I was weak.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's tough. I'll say at the point I actually did reach out, I was so glad it did. but it took a very long time to get there.
Yeah, man. It's how do we break down these stigmas of like men's mental health? Like, how do we get men to get mental health? Because I look around at our society and I see a lot of breakdown. I know you're in Canada, but Canada and America have some similar issues. I know one thing here in America is so much gun violence and mass shootings and things like that. And I want to touch on that, but I might be getting ahead of ourselves, but so you with your girlfriend, and how did you cope with, being in an abusive relationship?
Yeah, so because I didn't feel like I could reach out to anyone, my solution to like take action of it all so no one knew was to start using drugs. And really at that point is when things got dramatically worse because one, you're just less able to cope with the things around you, but also yeah, it just makes things way, way worse.
Yeah, I can imagine. What drugs was it?
So it was majority of cocaine. I never like shot up anything or stuff like that. It was all just up the nose kind of thing.
Yeah.
But and the reality of it is too is that most cocaine's cut with meth in some form or another, and that's way more addictive. Maybe sometimes crack is cut in there too. But
Wow. I know down here and maybe up there in Canada too, there's a real issue with it being cut with fentanyl.
that too, yeah.
Yeah.
I to be honest, I just got lucky because I was doing a lot of drugs. And looking back, I'm like, holy man, like someone was looking out for me.
Yeah. Do you think like a lot of drug addiction kind of stems as like a coping mechanism?
I think more so than just like, I'm sure some people just think it's just like a genetic thing. It's like once an addict, always an addict. They're gonna be one. But I haven't met an addict that didn't have problems. Like they go together. So if you, in my opinion, if you take away those problems, the true problems, and how you feel about them, you're not gonna want to do drugs anymore. Like, I mean, I don't even know, 4 years, 3 years. I haven't
Yeah.
even touched anything.
That's
And
awesome.
yeah, I don't think about it. And it's
Yeah.
because I've done so much work on it.
That's awesome, man. So, since you had a experience, being addicted to drugs, drug addiction is a major problem in our society, especially like here in America. We have so many people addicted to opioids. How do we do a better job of like treating drug addiction?
Oh, that's a big question. In my opinion, rehab centers, but not just focused on like AA steps, but more of like a holistic approach. So you build a community, you work on, like I said, those things, the triggers of why you want to just learn about yourself, as well. Obviously, the systemic problems like like poorer neighborhoods obviously have more drugs and alcoholism, stuff like that. So that's, I mean, unfortunately, probably going to be there for a while.
Yeah, it's like an issue where I feel like nobody really knows where to begin on how to, it's such a complex issue. So you're
I
addicted to
know.
drug. Oh, I didn't mean to cut you off. Go on.
Yeah. I know in some cities in Canada, actually, they're starting to do homeless hotels, I think they call them. So they're actually putting people in nice rooms and hotels. They got a little kitchenette and stuff like that, because how are you supposed to stop using drugs when you don't have a place to shower or anything? Like, what's the point?
Yeah, recently with COVID, we have all this commercial real estate that's not being used. And my thing is like, put some homeless people up in those buildings, you know? Like
That's
maybe
a
the
good idea.
city could just like pay. Yeah, and I don't know why they don't do it, but you know, there's so much stuff going on in our society, and I feel like that I'm not gonna say the answers are easy, but I feel like we could be making positive steps in better direction, and we don't. So back to you being addicted to cocaine. So you eventually got clean. What led you to go on that journey to getting clean? When did you say like enough is enough?
To be honest, like I just spoke at a conference and I was trying to come up with one like moment where I was like, okay, things are gonna change for me. But I think it was a bunch of little small things that made me change my mind. I part of this journey too, I had a couple suicide attempts, and one was an intentional overdose. And after that, I had the feeling like, oh, geez, I can't even do that right. And it just kind of made me, it's a hard, it's not like I was motivated to live still, but it's like, okay, well, if that's not going to work, maybe I can try getting help. It's a weird thing to think about, and I think it's an experience I've heard from a lot of people too, is that afterwards something just changes.
Well, hey, I'm glad that suicide attempt didn't work out, man. I'm glad you're here with us. So, rehab, what was that like?
That was actually well, I'll go from the point of view of what I thought it was going to be before even. So I was freaked out. I thought there was going to be like these like crackheads and all these homeless people and the guys that are going to like stab me and all this stuff. Wasn't entirely the case. I had a better experience than I thought it was going to be, but we got roomed in a room with other, it was a men's only rehab center. So you got rooms with other people. And I don't know if this is true, but one of the guys in the room is like, oh, that guy that was in your bed a couple days ago, he died.
Oh,
So I
wow.
got into this room and he tells me that right before I like go to sleep and stuff. So I'm sitting there. I didn't sleep any that night because I was like,
Ghost is going to come and get you or something.
no, but honestly, I was there for, I think it was like 60 days. And just being in an environment where people are solely focused on becoming better, really helped me put into perspective, on, there's a lot of things that I'm doing that I need to humble myself, and take a step back and fix.
Awesome, man. So at this point, are you still with the abusive girlfriend or is she an
Oh,
ex?
heck no.
Heck no. All right,
Yeah,
so how did.
she's gone, well, since before I even went to rehab.
That's good. So I know there was during our email correspondence, you had talked about one specific event as well. You want to delve into that? Was that before or after rehab?
That was actually before. That was before
Before
rehab.
rehab.
Yeah, basically right after I ended my relationship with my ex there. So the way I kind of look at it is that relationship kind of made me into like the perfect victim in a sense. And because I was like isolated from not talking to my friends or family, the relationship itself destroyed my self-esteem, and obviously then I was addicted to meth and cocaine. But after that ended, I was seeking validation and connection really from anyone or anything around me. And unfortunately, it was with the wrong people and in a bad place. So basically I was drugged. I think it was ketamine, to be honest. It was just put in a drink. And well, after that, I mean, ketamine's kind of a dissociating drug, right? I remember everything that happened mostly. So I guess for all the listeners, I was drugged and raped by a group of women. And it's a weird thing as a man because it's like, oh, you're bigger than most women, probably. Is usually the case, but like, how did they get you to do that? And well, I was drugged and to the point where I couldn't even like stand by myself, probably. But yeah, at the time, definitely, obviously, like I was out of it. Didn't scare me at the time, so it's more so the aftermath of realizing what actually happened, and like coming to reality about what it was.
Yeah, man. So when you came to reality of what it was, did you, how did you, I don't know the right word, like heal, or how did you overcome
Yeah.
that event?
So, well, off the bat, this is like when my drug usage dramatically increased. And I was like to the point where I was like having psychotic breaks all the time. And I was completely isolated. So the drug dealers actually dropped me off at the hospital one time, just at the front door, because I was having a psychotic break.
Yeah.
So yeah, so that's how I dealt with it now. And this was almost 6 years ago now. It's weird, time flies, but
It does.
as I've been going to school and stuff, I've been very lucky to have the opportunity and the time to study this stuff, and it's what I enjoy as well, and I want to help other people, but it's also it's for me. That was the main reason I wanted to go back to school. So I was looking up different therapies and stuff, and a big one for me was EMDR, so eye movement reprocessing and desensitization.
EMDR. So
Yes.
what, say that again. You said eye movement.
Eye movement, desensitization, and reprocessing.
Reprocess. What's the M stand for? Oh, eye movement.
Eye
All right,
movement,
gotcha. All right, yeah. So what is that? What kind of therapy? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah, it's a trauma therapy for like really deeply embedded trauma, and so basically, you can even do it online or in person. I do mine online. Is you follow their finger across the screen, going side to side, with your eyes, and it's something about the bilateral movements between your left and right eyes that unlocks emotions. So there was actually a long time since I like got sober that I honestly hadn't even, it was hard to feel emotions. I was like, yeah, I'm sober, but I didn't feel anything. And I started doing this EMDR, and it got to the point where I was absolutely uncontrollably bawling after a session because I felt so like sad and so much compassion for myself. And that's how I was like healing from it, because I thought that what happened to me was my fault. And that's what this was therapy was doing, is kind of well, letting it out, allowing
Yeah.
me to grieve about it.
So that's interesting. So when you're moving the finger back and forth, is somebody like talking to you? Are they asking you questions, or is it just silent, or?
Yeah, so that's the cool thing too, is like you can do it as a future like counselor. I want to do this too. You don't even need to get the client to speak out loud what they're thinking, but you just want to direct them. So you'll go for 30 seconds, for example, and they'll be like, okay, what did you think about? What came to mind? And think random things. Well, just whatever comes to your mind, and you go with it again. Then you do another 30 seconds, and then eventually I don't know how it works really. You get to this point where you're like, oh, that's why I feel that way. And then that's when the tears come.
That's interesting. Yeah. And you
Yeah.
say you do this online. Is it like, well, like a video conference, like what we're doing now?
Yeah, pretty much. Yeah. It's
Yeah.
I don't know, telehealth or whatever you want to call it. Yeah.
That's interesting. You know, when you say follow a finger back and forth, it kind of reminds me of hypnotism. You know, the hypnotist would have the pocket watch going back and forth. Is there any kind of connection there?
Not that I know of. I'm sure there is some connection because hypnotism, my understanding is it like puts you in a trance almost, right? Like in a calm state. So I wonder if that's part of the EMDR, is it puts you in a calm state and then you're directed into thinking about these emotions. I don't know.
Yeah,
That's a
I
good
think maybe
question.
somebody should investigate that, you know? Like, I feel like there's a connection there. I wonder how they even discovered that, you know?
Actually, how they did is the creator was walking through on a walk, I think, in a park, and they just realized that they were looking to their side at the trees in a far distance, but they were looking between the two. And they realized they felt quite calm doing it. And then they just it was fortunately like a researcher that thought of it. So
Yeah, well, I'm glad that guy figured that out. So you also mentioned another therapy that was very useful to you.
I can't remember which one I told you. Was it internal family systems?
Let's see here. Let me pull up the email. Let's see here. Yeah, you said CBT.
Oh, CBT, yeah, cognitive behavioral therapy. So that's basically your generalized talk therapy, really, and I'm for anyone that's really, I don't know. Have you done any therapy yourself?
No, I have not,
No.
but
Yeah.
I've always been interested in it. Everybody is sort of talking about mental health now. It's kind of the buzzword of the moment. And I believe that is a good thing, but I also wonder if we as a society are actually talking about mental health in a productive way. You know, when I get on Instagram, I see all these advertisements for telehealth kind of stuff. And I wonder, is this like a legitimate, do people really care? Or is this just another cash grab?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's there's obviously some of that too, and it's unfortunate, and it takes advantage of some people. But to be honest, I think even in the worst, well, you can get have damage done from therapy if it's not done by a professional. But I would say in most cases it is helpful, especially with a therapy like CBT, that's cognitive behavioral therapy, and I would say that's the therapy that most people know about, but it's not just talking about the things. So there's obviously the cognitive part is like your thoughts, and then the behavior part is like, okay, so you're having these thoughts that cause these behaviors, and these behaviors cause these thoughts. So let's look at one of these thoughts. And let's change it, and then our behavior is going to change.
All right.
So it's very
So,
purposeful.
and this is kind of the therapy where like you're like sitting on the couch or whatever, like kind of
Yeah,
talking
kind of.
to
I
the
mean,
shrink.
the ones where you're like laying down on the big futon, that's like more like Freudian therapy. That's a little, in my opinion, a little wishy-washy, but
Yeah, that's interesting, man.
yeah.
So you're studying psychology. Now, here's something I've always wondered. What is the difference between psychology and psychiatry?
Oh, good question. A psychiatrist is a medical doctor that specializes in psychometry and pharmacology of like the brain, I guess. So a psychiatrist is who will prescribe you pills. And I'm almost certain it's the same in the States, that they're the only ones who can. A general practitioner, your family doctor, can also prescribe those pills, but they're not an expert in it. So they don't always know what the best option is for you. And a psychologist is someone really who just studies the mind. And there's tons of fields in psychology. My degree specialization is actually cognitive neuroscience or neuropsychology. So I'm looking at the neurons and the pathways, the parts of the brain, and how do they influence your behavior, stuff like that. So, but I the biggest difference is that a psychiatrist is a doctor, a psychologist is a counselor, a researcher, just focused on behavior mostly.
Right there. So, what's your learning in school? Has it helped you personally?
Oh, geez, tremendously. I actually, because I have such a passion for well, I want to know all this stuff because I'm like, I want to figure out what's wrong with me. How do I feel better? So, the stuff that's been the most helpful, I've actually later come across in my classes. But I've already been exposed to it and stuff. So I would say the classes, the degree itself is just amazing, and you learn so much about yourself.
That's awesome, man. So you're in school now. You completed rehab. You've been clean for 4 years. You said a part of your journey was about how to go beyond being a victim. Do you feel you're at that point now? And if so, how did you get to that point? Like, was it just rehab, you hopped out and you were all good, or was it more to it?
Yeah, definitely. So I would say after rehab, I more so learned that things could be better, but I didn't discover how to get there at that point, but at least opened my eyes and told me that I can keep on going. And then I think working on my triggers with a counselor was a big one. 'Cause I was like I don't know, a walking trigger. I don't know what everything was bothering me, even unconsciously. And I was overwhelmed and anxious, depressed, but I was using all of my energy to try to survive. But when I was able to understand why I was acting the way I was and why I had certain feelings, that energy that I was devoting to trying to stop that feeling went away because I released it and I kind of integrated it into who I was and I allowed myself to feel that way. So that was one of the first things that I learned to do. After that, like I just mentioned, integration. I realized that recovery or healing isn't just about understanding what's wrong and why, what all the negative things, but you have to figure out there's the other side of things where if you're not happy, you have to figure out what makes you happy. So that was a big thing in my journey is that focusing on what makes me happy instead of what doesn't make me happy. And at that point, then my energy was devoted to good things, I guess, in a way.
Hey, sorry to interrupt, but are you looking to reach a dynamic and engaged audience of curious minds? Well, look no further. Bright Brains Podcast is the perfect platform to showcase your business or product. You'll be able to reach a diverse, intelligent audience and engage with listeners passionate about personal development, technology, and more. Elevate your brand through thought-provoking discussions. Don't miss this opportunity to promote your business on one of the fastest-growing podcasts in the market. Contact us today to discuss advertising options and elevate your brand to the next level. Contact us at brightbrainspod@gmail.com to secure your advertising spot on Bright Brains today. Again, that's brightbrainspod@gmail.com. Now, back to the podcast.
All right, so you said focus on the things that make you happy. How does that look in practice? Are you just, let's say you like strawberry milkshakes. Are you just thinking about strawberry milkshakes all day, or?
I guess if you, food's a different one, but like, yeah, I guess if you want to do that, or because I experienced addiction, I know what it's like to be addicted to something, even if it's like food and stuff. So my idea was that I was going to be as open-minded as I could, and I'm going to try all these different things, and I'm going to see which ones I like. And then if I didn't like something, I would always have something that like made me happy, I guess. Yeah, and I guess to add on that point too, because you've heard like the whole thing about like, then don't think about a purple elephant.
No, I haven't heard that before.
Oh, really? Okay, so yeah. Like when I say don't think of a purple elephant, what do you think of?
A purple elephant.
Yeah, so it's the exact same thing as like thinking about using all your energy to not do something, compared to if I was to tell you like, okay, think about exercising today instead of think about not eating that bag of chips on the couch.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, it makes sense. All right. Yeah, so if you think about the bag of chips, you're going to eat the bag of chips. But if you think about
it, you're more likely to. Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to exercise. All right. So somewhere along this journey, you said you found out that you have bipolar disorder. So what is bipolar disorder?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, it's depression and mania. There's for the most part, just three general types, cyclothymia, bipolar 2, and then bipolar 1. Bipolar 1 being the most severe, and that's characterized by like extreme mania and extreme depression. What I was diagnosed with is bipolar 2. So it's mostly hypomania and depression. And for the most part, it's often just diagnosed as depression because most of the time you only have depressive episodes. But in the DSM, you can be, as long as you have one manic episode, you can be diagnosed with bipolar. And that was the case, actually, with me. After I was diagnosed, I looked back to all these things. So I was like, I actually did wonder why I felt the way I did growing up and stuff. And the drugs just brought that out, that part of me out.
Yeah, man. You know, there's so much mental illness in our society. How do we go about treating that? I know it's kind of a big question. I know I asked this big question, you know, I asked about how to treat drug addiction. I know you don't really have the answer because you're just one guy, but it seems like maybe mental illness is on the rise. I don't know if that is actually happening or it's just my, what I sense. But how do we get more people, especially men, which is the topic, to seek help?
That's a really good question. I think, you know, getting groups of men together that actually feel comfortable talking. Like, if you generally have a group of men that are comfortable talking with each other, it doesn't have to be like a sob fest and talking. It's like, okay, I go here. And I say like, oh, this is this problem I'm happening. And I can't focus on anything else. And you have these guys to vent to, and it doesn't need to be a big deal. But I think it's kind of made to be a big deal that that men don't want to be weak in that sense. And it just in not just for men, but stigma in general. That's kind of why I want to share my story, is that the more you hear other people talking about it, the less stigma there is about it, and the more people feel comfortable about talking and sharing their story and don't feel shame for something happening to them.
Are women better at sharing their feelings with each other than men, or is that just a stereotype?
Off the top of my head, I would say I think it's statistically women are more easily, in North American culture at least, more able to talk about their emotions.
Yeah. Why is that? It's just different gender roles lead to different outcomes or anything.
For the most part, I would say it's the culture around it, but then again, there's also like the bio side of things, like I'm sure estrogen plays a part in it. Stuff like the higher levels, like testosterone, plays a part in men's behavior too, right?
So you also said that you worked with boys on the autism spectrum. How did that opportunity come about, and what was it like?
So I was looking for work, and it just happened out of I was on Indeed, and I was just like applying for like tons of jobs, and I didn't even think I would get this job because I felt like I was completely underqualified. I ended up getting the job, and this is just 2 years ago, actually. And honestly, so I worked with boys between, I think the youngest was 13 to 18. And they were nonverbal autistic boys, meaning like they're pretty high on the spectrum. So it's a unique experience seeing how someone who can't communicate and is very emotional, and how you deal with that is a really unique experience, and actually, like, I think prepared me for my son in a way. It's like him crying now is like nothing compared to what I had to do with those boys. Unfortunately, it's sad seeing that with them, but it's the case,
Yeah.
yeah.
So how do you get through to an 18-year-old? At that point, it's a man. How do you get through to someone who's nonverbal but emotional?
Basically, you repetition and like basic I guess like conditioning in a way. That's how actually the treatment for autism, I shouldn't say treatment, but like how to help someone with autism, build them the right behaviors, like you don't slap someone in the face kind of thing, right? Because they don't know that. So there's just like rewards and punishments that you work with them to get there. And that's basically like the gold standard of working with them.
Gotcha. And then you also said you worked at a crisis helpline. I imagine that could be a pretty stressful job. How was that?
So I'm still doing it. Yeah, I agree. It is stressful sometimes. In there's just the 988, which is a suicide hotline. I think you've had it in the States for a while, but it just got opened up in Canada now. It's a texting hotline.
Wait, hold on one second. Are you saying that Canada didn't have a suicide hotline?
They didn't. I think they had a call line, potentially. But now there's a text line, so people could just text in like, "Hey, I feel like killing myself." But yeah, I just I know it's been in the States for a while though.
Yeah, it's been in the
Yeah.
States for as long as I can remember. You know, in the States, anytime there's anything, remotely dealing with suicide in the media right after they have that number. I can't call off the top of my head, but it's right there, right? Even if when I post this audio on YouTube, there's probably gonna be like a little box at the bottom that says suicide, call this number, blah blah blah. And I guess that's good. I imagine it's saved a lot of people. So walk me through it.
I was
What were
just
you
going to
saying?
say, like in Canada, the texting line. So there's the suicide hotline, there's Kids Help Phone, there's Wellness for You. There's about five or six different lines you can text into, and there's about a million conversations every year.
Oh wow. So how many people, all right, so you're in there and I'm imagining you're like in a call center or maybe you work from home.
I work from home, yeah.
Yeah. So like what kind of calls do you deal with? I know you probably can't give anything personal probably because of like laws and stuff, but I can only imagine the kind of issues that people come to you with. What's it like?
Yeah, so on one side of the spectrum, I would say there's someone's having trouble with stressing about their schoolwork and their family, and it's just too much. And not to I think their experience is still important and stuff, but it's not a life or death situation. But then you have other people that are imminent risks that they text and they're saying, I want to do it now. And they're difficult to respond to. And it's twice now, actually, that I've had to work with a supervisor, and we actually ended up calling 911 to do a house call,
Oh,
because we were scared they're actually gonna commit suicide.
wow.
So those conversations are heavy. There is support systems for us on there. I think if you know what you're dealing with and you know that you're doing the best you can, it's not so overbearing.
Yeah, I can imagine, it's can be kind of stressful as well. So how many hours a day? Is it just like a clock in, clock out kind of a job or?
Yeah, it's like really casual. You can do up to 12 hours. You just book your own shifts, because it's volunteer, right? So I honestly, with school and everything and looking after my son, I usually only do 4 hours a week. But obviously if I ever have free time, I sometimes will jump on.
Hey, that's awesome, man. Thank you for your service. So you're in school studying psychology. What grade are you in?
So technically, I guess I would be, you call me in my fourth year.
Gotcha,
Normally,
senior.
yeah, normally you take 4 years, but because, I was working, at the house with the boys with autism, and had my son, I was doing less classes, so I took it next year. So I'll be done next year. So I'll take 5 years.
Man, that's awesome, man. So let's pivot and talk more about, the state of men's mental health. So when you graduate, you said you eventually want to open up your own practice and help men with their mental health. What does that look like for you?
Yeah, I think one, I'm hoping that them seeing that I'm a person that is comfortable sharing my story and that I've had a change and things can get better, that people, men in particular, will be interested in working with me. I also think that, and I'll have to do a lot of studying on this as part of what I want to do for research in grad school, is like what works best for men. Because it's not for men, it's not always just like talking about your feelings. Sometimes men want to be given the tools to figure it out themselves. And that's how they find their like autonomy, and they feel better about themselves, right? Because that's what they've always known.
Do you think that one of the reasons why men are hesitant to seek out therapy is that therapy, in a sense, kind of has like a feminine kind of stigma to it?
I think so, yeah. Yeah, it's
Yeah.
definitely a part of
How do we overcome that?
it. Again, I think framing masculinity as being not that you can't share your emotions, but you're in control of your emotions. So, in my opinion, I see a man that's struggling and stuff. I'm not demeaning that man in any way, but like, I don't think he's being a man by causing damage to the people around him by holding on to anger and all this stuff. And it's just more helpful to be a strong man who can lead other people.
Yeah, I agree. Do you feel, I keep hearing in the media all these phrases like masculinity is in a crisis, or fragile masculinity. We hear about men falling behind and things like that. Why do you think that is? It seems like it's just, like I said, a crisis. Is it men's fault that this is happening, or is it something to do with society? Well, what's going on?
I think it's in part with society. It's because, like, I don't know, men are kind of in a position, it's a weird position now, where they're told they have the privilege of being a man. They get paid more, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then because of that, they shouldn't be allowed to be like sorry for what happened. And they carry the shame that comes with that privilege, and they have no place to decompress from it.
Yeah, there's all of this privileged discourse going on. And I have a unique take on this. Obviously, as you could tell, I'm a black man, and black people in America haven't been treated the best. And I do think there's a time and place to talk about, privileges and historical privileges. But I feel like maybe we as a society, maybe it's gotten to the point where it's kind of damaging. Because if you're constantly telling somebody, like, hey, this person has it better than you, like this man, this white man, or this woman, or if you say to this woman, hey, you're failing because you're not privileged, if you tell that gay person or that black person. And I'm wondering, like, I feel like it's a fine line. Like, I feel like we can't forget the past, but I feel like this constant drumbeat in the media about who's privileged, it doesn't get us anywhere. And I think maybe it might lead to some mental illness. What's your take on that?
Oh, definitely. 'Cause it's like, I don't know, it's almost like making people feel like having they can get learned helplessness, which is just like they really don't feel they can do anything about it.
Yeah, and that's the thing too, overcoming that. I also think one issue is there's so many people who just they kind of take up a cause to make money, even if they don't believe in it. Like, there are all these influencers now, like these alpha male influencers, like Andrew Tate. And, there's a whole plethora of podcasts, and I think that a lot of men lack positive role models. What do you think of that? And do you think there are some positive role models in the media for for men and boys?
Yes, I think the problem right now, in my opinion, the role model for men is the one that has character and like good morals and stuff. And they're not going to bash the other person. They're just worried about how do I make myself better than the people around me? And that's what it, I think, a good role model is. But, you know, like it's the same in Canada as in the state, probably a little worse in the states with the polarization of things.
Yeah.
So people like exaggerate their points of view so much that what actually probably was rational and probably the way to look at things is no longer, because they took it to the extreme.
Yeah, the internet kind of, it's like a magnifying glass. It kind of blows everything out of proportion, which can be good or bad, because there are some issues like, George Floyd, I think that needed to be magnified. But then sometimes you can magnify things so much that it can become a hindrance. So how do we use technology to help people or help men in their mental health?
I think they're, like I said before, is men meeting together and having groups. If there's like online communities, that's a amazing way to build up men. And what the heck is that guy's name? There's a YouTube channel. It's like that dad that like shows you how to do things for people that don't have a dad. Just like stuff like that. It's like it's so awesome.
Yeah, it is. I think we need more positive role models. Like, do you think like men should look up to celebrities at all?
To be honest, I don't know if a celebrity is actually very knowledgeable in what they do. Maybe you should listen to them, but I feel like most of the time they're just a talking piece.
Yeah. One thing, I have this idea. I don't know, it might seem a little out there, right? So you know what Chat GPT is, right? It's like an AI type of thing. I wonder if we could use AI to be like a digital therapist for people, because we talk about how more people need mental health help, but there aren't enough people in that industry. What if there was like a like how I'm talking to you over Zoom, I could go to a website and talk to like a digital person and, help them with their issues. I wonder if that would be beneficial.
I think it would actually. I like right now, I don't know if it's a thing yet, but I could see it being feasible to have like almost like a before meeting with a therapist, you meet with this like therapist AI bot and they can give you resources. You type in like, oh, this is what's wrong. They can give you resources and like knowledge on what you should be doing. And then afterwards, if you want to see that therapist, they'll get you to talk to the therapist. But if I think sometimes just reading about and learning about yourself is enough, and I think it AI could do that.
You said reading about yourself. What do you mean by that?
Oh, yeah, just like kind of reading, even just like articles. Psychology Today is one I actually read quite often, just about different concepts in psychology. And I mean, search so like, if you search depression, you can find the symptoms of depression, possible causes of depression. You could see that it's similar to burnout, stuff like that. And I guess, yeah, then you just learn about yourself, like, oh, with a little introspection, you can learn.
See what you mean. So you said you have a son, correct?
I do.
So when you're raising your son, like what are some changes that like based on what you've learned and what you want to help men in society, what are some ways that you're going to help your boy grow into a man? I ask this question because there are so many young boys out here who just seem lost, who can need guidance. So what are some things that you may do differently with your son?
So what I'm already doing is just like be involved. I think that's like the number one correlation to delinquency is not having a father. So if you can just be like really involved with shaping how your kids grow up, and I think in the general sense that mothers are generally more loving with their kids because they have that bond with them already. It's already built. And then just how the baby, a baby actually, I think it's up until 6 months, doesn't even separate themselves from their mother. They think they're the same person. And then having another person in there, like a father, for example, lets them feel comfortable connecting with another person besides themselves. I don't know if that's too.
I think I get what you're saying.
Yeah, so it builds their self-esteem, and being involved and showing them how to do things, et cetera, is how you would build a strong man, for example, or even a strong daughter.
So why is it that, fatherlessness is such a dramatic predictor of delinquency and crime? I think most men in prison haven't had fathers in their lives. Why is it? I know women seem to get affected too, but it seems like it has a major effect on boys more than girls. So, like, what is it about fatherlessness? And I feel like this issue, if we could just fix that, it would fix a lot of things in our society. But what's your take on that?
Again, I think even if a person is fatherless, if they have a good male role model in their life, they'll have someone to, because kids just watch you. Like, I know it's my son already. He's just like, I'll catch him just looking at me. I'm like, what are you thinking? You're absorbing what I'm doing right now. Am I frowning right now? Or are you gonna be like, oh, so.
They learn from us, and kids are like sponges, man. So yeah, this has been a great topic, man. We've talked for like about an hour now. Is there any issue, like something that you wanted to cover that we didn't touch on?
You know what? Nothing really. I guess maybe we could touch on suicide, because there's actually it's crazy. Like in Canada here, I wonder if you have an idea how many, what percent of suicides do you think are men?
I know it's the vast majority. They say that women attempt suicide more, but men succeed, which, that's not something to be proud of or nothing. But yeah, so yeah, but I know it's the majority of suicides are men.
Yeah, I was just looking at the Mental Health Commission of Canada. It's 75% of suicides are men.
That's wild, man. And why is that?
Well, I think part of it, like you said, is that men choose the option that I don't know, gets the job done is a way to look at it. Making sure it happens. Not sure why that is though. Just seems to happen that way, I guess. And you know, the fact that they don't feel like they can reach out, and it bubbles to a point where they can't take it anymore. And rather than reach out, they'll take charge of their life. They'll, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely sad. 75%, man. That's
It's
we gotta.
shocking, yeah. Because women are actually more likely to be diagnosed with like depression and stuff like that as well.
Now, interestingly enough, in Canada, they have legalized suicide now, right?
Oh, yeah.
So what's the deal with that? Because I saw something recently where it was a veteran. He had PTSD, and he said that the hospital told him to kill himself.
I read about that one. That one's that's crazy. Well, it's like it's made, right? And they're kind of just opening it up to, I don't know, it seems like it's going the way to anything. If you want to, you can do it.
What's your take? Do you think it should be legal?
You know, I'm kind of in between, because I really think that someone should have control over how they go. And if they are truly in a situation where they're just sitting in pain, it might be the better option. But to let it go to the point where if someone's just depressed, where something that's treatable, like it's different when you're 97 and your body's failing you. But if you have depression and things are bad right now, like when I was suicidal, I don't think I would have actually, but like it would have been easy to make that decision. Like, okay, yeah, this is a good idea.
Yeah, I wonder what all goes into it. Do they have to sit down with like a therapist? I feel like it shouldn't be an easy thing to do,
It actually it isn't that easy. I can't remember. There is somewhat of a process that they have to go through. They have to get signed documents. They have to prove that they're of sound mind. Yeah, there's a few things, but yeah, it is
Gotcha.
scary. Like there was even talking about like if you're homeless, you could use it.
Heard that. And what's interesting, I think Canada has a huge homelessness problem right now. So my fear is that the government could just use this suicide to fix any kind of social ill,
Right.
And
And go ahead.
I mean, cut. Well, I was just gonna say, there was two articles, or two little news snippets I saw actually earlier today. One of them was this woman, she said she had chronic fatigue syndrome and she chose to end her life. I don't know what that is. So I don't know what it's like to live with that. Maybe that, maybe, I don't know. It's not my place to say. But there was another woman, she had autism, bipolar, and depression. And she's in the news now because she's choosing to end her life. I don't think this is Canada, though. I think it's another one of those, like Poland or Switzerland type places. But
Yeah, I think it is. That country. It's scary in my opinion, 'cause the whole thing about like youth now and the whole them having rights to decide who they should be and all this stuff, and parents should have rights and stuff like that. How scary would that be if your son or daughter could just choose to kill themselves because they feel depressed?
yeah, that is scary. That is extremely scary. And if you had said that to me 5 years ago, I'll probably be like, that'll never happen. Don't be stupid. But nowadays, I look at the world and the world's kind of gone crazy. I could see it happening.
Yeah, no.
A little kid is sad because he didn't get his toy for Christmas, and then, he goes to a clinic and just kills himself. But maybe that's a little too extreme, but these are questions we gotta have, man. So
It's
I
kind
guess one,
of,
we'll go on, yeah.
yeah, I just, it's a slippery slope, I guess, but it seems like it's always getting pushed farther and farther. Because I don't know, was it like 10 years ago, the debate was whether someone with, I don't know if it was like terminal cancer or something on their deathbed could choose to do it like 2 days before they actually would die.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like a person with terminal cancer, like, I know for me, I would never do that. But if I was like paralyzed from the neck down, I can understand somebody doing something like that, but just saying you're depressed, I mean,
Yeah, no, it's different when that's my biggest problem with it is when something's treatable or potentially treatable, even though it's difficult for you right now, I don't think it should be legal.
Exactly.
But
So let me ask this one last question and we can wrap it up. So if someone is interested in getting mental health help or therapy, how do they go about it? It seems like there's so many options and it seems kind of overwhelming. So where do they begin?
I would honestly, how I found my therapist was going on Psychology Today. You just Google Psychology Today counselors in whatever city you're in, and a list of them will come up. They have a profile. You can see what they're trained in. You can see their qualifications because you want to make sure that they're actually a professional. I would like make sure that you advocate for yourself. It's actually my experience too that I've met with therapists that I did not click with. And if it doesn't feel comfortable with you, that it's not going to work, just leave that therapist. Like it's not going to be helpful for you to do that. But I would honestly start there. And also I would say most cities have health centers. See if you they have people that can help direct you to services in the area. I know in Canada, like for men, there's a good one I know is Heads Up Guys. That one's for depression, suicide in men, how to find a therapist there. But yeah, Psychology Today is the big one.
Let's see here. What was I about to say? So here's what I want to ask. In Canada, this stuff is free, right? So if somebody wants a therapist, it's paid for, correct?
Yes and no. There are now especially lots of services that are coming out that are free, but they're the wait lists for them are quite long. Still in Canada, you have to pay for services from a therapist.
Yeah, that's one obstacle. I feel like the people who probably need it the most probably can't afford it, you know?
And that's where those services come into play. There is also a thing too, for people. If you're can't afford a therapist rate, you can ask them about, say you can't afford it, do you have a sliding scale? And a lot of therapists do, and they'll have they can give you a better rate for their services.
All right then. That's awesome. All right then, man. So do you have anything to promote before we wrap it up?
You know what? If you want to follow me on LinkedIn, I'm starting to post more stuff on there. It's Julian Quickstad. I also run a podcast with my wife. It's called Psychology with My Wife. And you can find that on all the platforms. And on there, we, much like we're doing here, we talk about psychology topics and try to learn a little bit something, but as if we're sitting around a table talking, having a coffee.
Right, then, awesome. I'll definitely check it out, and I hope my audience does too. All right, then, Julian, this has been a great discussion. I just want to say thanks again for coming on and opening up to us. This has been great and very informative. You take care.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. This is awesome.
No problem. All right, that's a wrap. Thank you for joining us for another enlightening conversation here on Bright Brains. I hope you've gained valuable insights and inspiration to fuel your own bright ideas. If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe, rate, and leave a review on your favorite podcast platform or however else you listen to this podcast. Also, we can be found on all major social media. Just type in Bright Brains with a Z. And remember, the brightest minds are those that never stop seeking knowledge.